Good morning.
The reason there was the delay is that I began to lose my voice this morning. So we were going to try and set up a speaker so that I wouldn't have to project. But we'll see if my voice will warm up instead of go away. And if you can't hear me at some point, just wave your arms and remind me to speak louder again. How many of you were not here yesterday? Okay. I will give a mini review so that today's story won't be totally out of context. My name is Marilyn Fenn. I work here at Holden as a registrar. Glad to have you this morning. I'm usually a soprano instead of a bass. What we have begun to do with the Gospel of John is to look at the familiar story of which has been called by many people the beloved gospel, the favorite gospel. We've tried to understand it as it was first written in the 90s AD, and for a community that went through some peculiar and unique historical circumstances which shaped and formed the Gospel of John into not only their story of how they saw the carpenter Jesus, but also the story of their own persecution history and faith history in that first century of Christianity. Within this Johannine community, begun by a man who was a Jew, who was a follower of John the Baptist, and then came to become a follower and close disciple, though not one of the 12 disciples of Jesus. Through this man begins a community of faith which tries to speak about the messiahship or the messianic Jesus and the fact that this Jesus is more than human, that he is also God in the flesh. And because of this radical view and belief about Jesus, Orthodox Jews are offended. They hear this as a denial of the Jewish confession from Deuteronomy 6:4, the Lord our God is one, which has been the martyrdom confession of Jews throughout history, whether it was the Holocaust in the 30s and 40s, or the persecution of Jews through the Middle Ages by the church. And because some Jews belonging to this sect who claimed that Jesus was the Messiah, because some Jews heard polytheism in this confession, they felt that their brother and sister Jews were being traitors to the faith, traitors to all of the Maccabeans who had died in 3rd century BC. Within their memory of maybe their grandparents, they had heard people, is this any good? They had heard stories of their relatives who had died to defend Judaism from compromise and from invasion by pagan polytheistic ideas. And so eventually this sect of Jews who follow this Jesus are excommunicated from the Jewish synagogues. This is after the temple has been destroyed, and now the center of Jewish worship has moved to the synagogues. The cultic worship of sacrifice in Jerusalem is no longer the center of their religion. It's in the synagogue, and they are put out of the fellowship, and they are no longer considered Jews legally either. Therefore, they are no longer under the protection of the Roman law, which excuses Jews from emperor worship. And therefore, many Christians either died directly at the hands of Jews being stoned for blasphemy, or died at the hands of Romans because they refused to worship the emperor, as all good Roman subjects and citizens were supposed to do. And so it is within this context of a community which has been persecuted intensively, both in the Gentile world and in the Jewish world, that we find the story of the blind man, which sits in chapter 9 of the Gospel of John. Now, in order to give you a little bit more context of where this story sits within the whole structure of the Gospel of John, I'll put a very simple diagram of the Gospel on the board. And again, this comes from our friend Raymond Brown. And I think it's a beautiful, easy way to kind of be able to imagine the book in your own mind and to set the different stories in more of a context than push chapter 1 to 21 and somehow this all is one continuous story. Brown claims that there are two major books within the Gospel of John, one called the Book of Signs and one called the Book of Glory. Glory meaning presence, not that shiny, ooey-eye religious stuff, but glory meaning the very presence of God. We have some little connecting pieces of literature. Here in the beginning, we have the prologue, which goes from John, verse 1 through 19 of the first chapter. 18, excuse me. And with 1, 19 through the end of chapter 10, we have a book of signs. And these are the miracles or the signs which point to Jesus as being more than the Messiah. He is the fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecy of a Davidic Messiah coming to usher in an eternal kingdom of God. But even more than that, he is also God who has come to pitch his tent among us, as the prologue in poetry and prose proclaims. We have the Book of Glory, and this begins with chapter 13 and goes to the end of chapter 20. And chapter 13 contains the story of the foot washing, where Jesus washes the feet of his disciples, sets a model for servanthood, that the least shall be the greatest. And this is the story of Jesus' passion. It begins with foot washing, the Last Supper account. And from 13 until the end of 20, we have the original story of the passion. 21 is an epilogue. It's both a pro and an epilogue to the Gospel of John. And 21 is the story of Jesus meeting the disciples by the Sea of Galilee. And it's when Peter brings him 154 fish to fry, an odd little number. If you were here for Jim Fish's Vespers, Larry's Vespers. He mentioned that odd number of fish that Peter brings Jesus. One idea is that in the Mideast, they know of 154 species of fish. And therefore, by bringing 154 fish, it's that all creation comes to the lordship of Jesus. That's one hypothesis. They keep playing with that one. So, the original book goes from the prologue, verse 1, through the end of chapter 20. And the climax of the book is where Thomas confesses, after doubting and doubting and doubting, refusing to believe that Jesus is both the Messiah and God in the flesh. He finally sees with his eyes, and it is that point that Thomas confesses, "My Lord and my God." And that is the big climax of the entire book. And it plays upon the continuing theme throughout the Gospel of John, this theme of sight and the theme of light. You find both of these throughout the Gospel. The story we're going to talk about today, out of chapter 9, is a theme of light and sight. Jesus says, "I am the light of the world," within that story. And the blind man is given sight, even so, in his experience of the risen Christ, Thomas is given the eyes of faith to see that this is not merely a man. Now, sitting right here in the middle, we have a story which connects these two books. The signs which point to the glory of God, the presence of God upon the cross, suffering servanthood. And to connect these two sections of the Gospel of John is the story of Lazarus. And it is the final sign, the epitome of all of Jesus' signs. And it also foreshadows the resurrection. Jesus prays and says to the crowd which is gathered at the tomb of Lazarus, "I am the resurrection and the life." And so he in this act of raising a man from the dead is a foretaste of what the entire Book of Glory is all about. So it is within the Book of Signs that we find chapter 9 and the story of the blind man. And there are amazing parallels between this story of a healed beggar who's blind from birth and the persecution history of the Yohanan community. Brown does a lot of sleuthing off of this story. And I think after we walk through this little tale together, a lot of the things that I stated as probable realities and descriptions of the Yohanan community, I think you'll begin to see why Brown formed this idea or formed this concept of the Yohanan community. It kind of jumps out at you when you start reading. I hope some of you at least have Bibles with you. That's not necessary. It's a story, and stories are often best when they're just spoken out loud and listened to. I'm going to read out of the International Version, the New International Version, because it has a little more punch to it, I think. But it's fun to read along in the RSV and see how sometimes the RSV, I think, can sound fairly pious and religious. And the International Version makes me realize that this was a real event and that this was really shaking people up.
What are you reading?
Chapter 9. As he went along, he saw a man blind from birth. Maybe I shouldn't do this. I'll probably lose my voice. Who loves to read? And I'll let them read it. Okay, good. I have a slash here. Stop. It's a long story, so relax. Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to remember to do this. I want you to listen for a few things so that when we come to pulling out the Yohanan clues of the story, it'll sound familiar to you. Listen for the I am statement of Jesus. Yesterday we discussed how the I am statements are a characteristic of the Gospel of John, but not of the Synoptics. Listen for the names which people use to address Jesus. There are 4 different names other than his name, Jesus or Yehoshua. And also listen for, this is going to sound odd, for the reference to spit. This has a lot of significance in the early church. So just pay attention to when that comes up. And then there are 3 interviews conducted of the blind man. He's interrogated 3 times, then has a 4th interview with Jesus himself. So just kind of, in your own mind, listen to how these different interviews dig at him and what they're trying to get him to say. Okay.
As he went along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" "Neither this man nor his parents sinned," said Jesus, "but this happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life. As long as it is day, we must do the work of him who sent me. Night is coming when no man can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world." Having said this, he spit on the ground, made some mud with the saliva, and put it on the man's eyes. "Go," he told him, "wash in the pool of Siloam." That word means sent. So the man went and washed and came home, seeing. His neighbors and those who had formerly seen him begging asked, "Isn't this the same man who used to sit and beg?" Some claimed that it was. Others said, "No, he only looks like him." But he himself insisted, "I am the man." "How then were your eyes opened?" they demanded. He replied, "The man they called Jesus made some mud and put it on my eyes. He told me to go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed, and then I could see." "Where is this man?" they asked him. "I don't know," he said. They brought to the Pharisees the man who had been blind. Now the day on which Jesus had made the mud and opened the man's eyes was a Sabbath. Therefore the Pharisees also asked him now how he had received his sight. "He put mud on my eyes," the man replied, "and I washed, and now I see." Some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath." But others asked, "How can a sinner do such miraculous signs?" So they were divided. Finally, they turned again to the blind man. What have you to say about him? It was your eyes he opened. The man replied, he is a prophet. The Jews still did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight until they sent for the man's parents. Is this your son, they asked? Is this the one you saw, you say, was born blind? How is it now that now he can see? We know he is our son, the parents answered, and we know he was born blind. But how he can see now, or who opened his eyes, we don't know. Ask him. He is of age. He will speak for himself. His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jews, for already the Jews had decided that anyone who acknowledged that Jesus was the Christ would be put out of the synagogue. That was why his parents said, he is of age. Ask him. A second time, they summoned the man who had been blind. Give glory to God, they said. We know this man is a sinner. He replied, whether he is a sinner or not, I don't know. One thing I do know, I was blind, but now I see. Then they asked him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? He answered, I have told you already, and you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you want to become his disciples too? Then they hurled insults at him and said, you are this fellow's disciple. We are disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses, but as for this fellow, we don't even know where he comes from. The man answered, now that is remarkable. You don't know where he comes from, yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners. He listens to the godly man who does his will. Nobody has ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. To this they replied, you were steeped in sin at birth. How dare you lecture us? And they threw him out. Jesus heard that they had thrown him out, and when he found him, he said, do you believe in the Son of Man? Who is he, sir? The man asked. Tell me so that I may believe in him. Jesus said, you have now seen him. In fact, he is the one speaking with you. Then the man said, Lord, I believe, and he worshipped him. Jesus said, for judgment I have come into this world, so that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind. Some Pharisees who were with him heard him say this and asked, what, are we blind too? Jesus said, if you were blind, you would not be guilty of sin. But now that you claim you can see, your guilt remains.
Thank you. Now what I'd optimally like to do is to pull the Johannine clues out of you. Now sometimes people get real uncomfortable when people try to do that in Bible studies, and it makes it a tooth extraction process for everyone concerned. So I would ask that whenever you think you've seen something, since this is all about sight, wave your arm. Let's forget about being conscious of whether you're talking too much or whatever. And if you don't feel comfortable saying anything, then I'll just keep blabbing on and on. But I would like for you to, right now, if any of you see anything significant in the story from what we talked about yesterday or at any point, flag me down. Anyone now? I'm not a very patient person. I won't wait long. Excuse me. Okay, the titles. If you have a Bible with you, you can glance down at these verses. And notice, one, the name with which Jesus is addressed, and the person who uses that name. I think throughout the story, we find a rise in Christology. We talked about that yesterday, Christology. The study of Christ, or of the divinity of Jesus, perhaps. And the first time Jesus is addressed in the story is in verse 2, and he's called Rabbi, which is another word for teacher. Now there are lots of rabbis running around Jerusalem and all of Judea and Palestine, Galilee, so that's not that unusual for someone to be addressed as Rabbi. That's a pretty human title to put upon someone. So Rabbi is the first one. And did anyone notice who used it? Right.
Okay, then in verse 17, the blind man, when asked by the Pharisees, okay, now, who do you think this guy is? And his reply, and I'll just call him the man for now. Then in verse 24, there's another discussion of Jesus' identity, or maybe his qualities, or state of human existence. Verse 24, he's called sinner. In Hebrew, to sin means to fall short of the mark. And so the blind man is arguing that, well, maybe this man isn't short of the mark, maybe he's the mark. God himself, instead of thinking of sin as some little individual act that you kind of blew, you did something you weren't supposed to. Sin as being falling short of relationship with God. Okay, and did anybody notice who called him a sinner or alluded that way?
The Jews.
And this story is a little less anti-Semitic than some. At least it gets specific enough to most of the time only blame the Pharisees that are present. Then in verse 38, there's another title. And again, it's the blind man who calls him this. Right. So the one who first called him only a prophet, through these interrogations and through the hours following the sign, this miracle of receiving sight when he's never seen before, we see an evolution in understanding even within the blind man in a very short space of time. And through the turmoil and the tension of people needling him with his confession of, oh, you think he's a prophet. Well, you think he's not even a sinner? And it's like within this tension of persecution almost, or which is a personification of persecution, he is actually thrown out of the synagogue. It says they put him out. It means they put him out of the synagogue. They wouldn't let him worship with them anymore. He's excommunicated. So it's within this turmoil that he realizes more and more who this Jesus is. It's not that in the negative circumstances that the faithful disciple throws up his hands and says, hey God, what's, you know, here I am being faithful and all I get is persecuted for it, which a lot of times people wonder why in the world Christians suffer. Well, we talked about that theme of expected persecution yesterday. And here again we find that the disciple, it's within persecution that the gut experience of Jesus grows sharper and one knows even more whom it is that is Lord. I was an English major too, so I'm always analyzing my grammar. Okay.
Would one other title be Son of Man?
Yes. And that's an important one. I'm glad you reminded me. Crazily enough, the title Son of Man is actually a divine title. Son of God, on the other hand, is an Old Testament title for heirs or kings. Often sons of God, is an Old Testament title for or reference to those within the covenant. However, Son of Man, especially in the Gentile pagan world, was another title for Savior. I told you that Gentiles would have been familiar with a story of a Son of God or Son of Man descending from heaven, taking on flesh, dying for humankind so that people could escape their earthly bodies and live eternally. That's also part of first century pagan Greek mystic religions, is what they were called. So here the title Son of Man is significant because he
it's claimed here that, yeah, this is not just the Messiah, which if you'll notice in verse 22, for the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess him to be Christ, other translations say Messiah. So if anyone even confessed him to be Messiah, they'd be excommunicated. He was to be put out of the synagogue. Well, here, the blind man is daring to call him Lord, and most radical of all, he falls at his feet and worships him. Now, if anything is going to offend a monotheistic Orthodox Jewish community, it is someone falling at the feet of a human being and worshiping them as a son of man, as God, being one with Yahweh. Extremely offensive. And the times throughout the Gospel of John in which Jesus is almost killed. He's stoned, but he flees, he runs away before they can start hurling the stones. Jesus is all the time hot-footing it out of tight situations. And what always gets him into the hot water is some kind of statement like, I and the Father are one. And the Jews see red, and they are ready to kill him for blasphemy. Stoning was the legal Jewish sentence for blasphemy. Sometimes they threw them off of the wall outside the Temple Mount and they fell down into the Kidron Valley to their death. Sometimes they stoned blasphemers. So they weren't just lightly or kind of offhandedly threatening Jesus' life. They heard what he said and heard what the blind man said as being treasonous, arch heresy within the Jewish faith and the Jewish national conscience. So the names are significant throughout the story, and the blind man receives visual sight right off, but throughout the story, his deeper sight, he begins to see not only just the sign, the healing, but the significance behind the healing, which points to the true identity of the healer. Okay, I told you we'd also be talking about the spit, the mud and saliva, and being smeared on his eyes. Now, what's real interesting is that archaeologists and biblical scholars have discovered that first century Christians, often at the time of their baptism, spittle and dust would be mixed together and smeared upon the baptismal candidate's eyes. And when they entered the baptismal, font, it was usually total immersion at that time. That would be washed off their eyes. And oftentimes it was this story of the blind man receiving his sight which was used as the baptismal liturgy. In other words, saying that when one is baptized, they receive sight for the first time in their life. They've never seen before, but by coming into relationship with Jesus, they see who it is that is truly Lord. They also often used oil in early baptisms, but I guess you probably haven't been to too many baptisms where they smeared mud on the baby's eyes. So that's not immediately applicable or understandable to us. But so the story was used, and perhaps even if the blind man was not a historical person, probably was. He probably was actually a beggar who was healed, and the beloved disciple witnessed this and wrote about it later. And the people of the first century, not having the same idea of history that we do, that when you relate history or truth, that every little tiny detail has to be empirically provable. Rather, truth is what you can often explain or reveal through stories, through what we would call fiction. And so this story is adapted and used and told by the beloved disciple and the Johannine community to explain what happens to a person when they become a disciple of Jesus, and to also explain the history and the experience of people within the community, so the baptismal candidate also can know what they can expect upon being willing to publicly confess whom it is that they believe Jesus to be. Okay, now let's go into the interviews. Maybe interrogations would be a better word. Okay, the first time where the blind man is questioned, did you notice what dear people first got him into the hot water? That's one, that's a little later. There are a lot of them packed in there. First of all, it's his dear neighbors. Those with whom he has lived all of his life, and now something radical has happened in his life, a radical change, and they are the ones who haul him off to the Pharisees. And so the neighbors take him for this first interview with those who know the law and keep the law. Now, the man is questioned. In different interviews, the emphasis on the one who's questioned, he gets most of the questions in his first interview. And did anybody notice what the Pharisees were really concerned with in their questioning of Jesus and of the blind man in his first interview? Keeping the Sabbath. Okay. If you are a devout Jew, you keep the Sabbath laws. There are certain things you do not do on Sabbath if you are a faithful Jew, an Orthodox Jew. And what's the exact wording of the question? If I can find it. Does anybody see the verse right off? Okay, 13 and 14. Now it was the Sabbath day. The Pharisees again asked him how he had received his sight. And they said, he put clay on my eyes, and I was washed, and I see. Then the Pharisees conclude, this man is not from God. He does not keep the Sabbath. Now, is there a law against healing on the Sabbath? That wasn't the case. What was the case, that according to Jewish law, making clay was breaking the Sabbath law. So that's why they grill the blind man and say, how did he do it? Because they can pin him down if they can find that he did work on the Sabbath, and they can accuse him of not being Orthodox, of not being a devout Jew. And so when they do find out that, yes, by George, he did do work. He made clay, and therefore he broke the law, and how can he be the one sent from God if he even breaks God's law? So, not too successful, either for the blind man or for Jesus' reputation in this first interview. They're not really satisfied with that. They question the blind man's identity. This guy has been healed, so they think, okay, now let's try and discredit that this is even the same man. And so they call in, who should know who he is? The parents. Now what do the gentle parents say in response? It also says why the parents are so unwilling to answer questions. Right. They are afraid of excommunication. They would no longer be able to be a worshiping member of the Jewish community if they're not careful, because anyone who confesses Jesus as Messiah is tossed out of the synagogue. Now, this was not true at the time that Jesus actually lived and walked on earth. People were not thrown out of the temple or out of synagogues because they listened to him or because they confessed his name. It was in 85 AD that the Jewish leaders officially formulated a curse against unorthodox Jews, and where they began a legal and constant practice of excommunicating anyone who confessed Jesus as Messiah. Or it didn't actually, in the actual words of the prayer, it curses the unorthodox. It doesn't zero right in on members of the sect who are professing Jesus. But because we find this sentence within a story which is supposedly talking about something that happened at the time of Jesus, it's one more clue that this is an expression and a relation of the experience of the Johannines, not something that was literally true at the time of Jesus and the blind man's experience with Jesus. So Raymond Brown makes a big point of this. Super Sleuth strikes again. Then we have a third interview, and it is with the man once more. Now this is really interesting. They really begin to apply the pressure. These are not easy, gentle little questions the Pharisees are asking, like, come on, why don't you tell us who he is? But what they do is, let me find him. Should try to use two Bibles at the same time. 24? Okay. A second time they summoned the man who had been blind. Give glory to God, they said. We know this man is a sinner. Now, give glory to God comes out of Joshua 7:19. And it's like saying, okay, fella, put your hand on the Bible and swear. It is not a gentle kind of admonition to tell the truth. It's saying, fess up. Give us the truth. We don't believe what you're saying. Now come clean. They are claiming that they know Jesus is a sinner. His reply, whether he is a sinner or not, I do not know. We talked about the different kinds of knowledge, knowing in the Gospel of John. This know is I don't know it as a fact. Whether he's a sinner or not, I don't know that for a fact. One thing I do know, one thing I understand, it's in my guts, I have experienced it. I was blind, but now I see. They asked him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? They hark back to that same point of the law. He answered, I have told you already and you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you want to become his disciples too? Now to me this sounds like Jewish sarcasm. The Bible is full of Jewish sarcasm, but lots of times I think in the Christian faith, we don't think God has a sense of humor, and the Jews know he does. So we miss a lot of the fun. Then they hurled insults at him and said, you are this fellow's disciple. We are disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses for a fact. But as for this fellow, we don't even know where he comes from. So there's hostility here. There's antagonism. The man answered, now that is remarkable. You don't know where he comes from, yet he opened my eyes. I mean, he's absolutely astounded at their blindness. We know that God does not listen to sinners. We know that for a fact. He listens to the godly man who does his will. Nobody has ever heard of opening the eyes of a blind man. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. So the blind man is saying, the sign is here. You have to deny the sign. And that we have experienced is both a fact and a gut experience. And here you are trying to be schizophrenic and deny this reality. And here this blind man is telling the Pharisees how blind they're being. Well, they don't take too kindly. They replied, you were steeped in sin at birth. How dare you lecture us? And they threw him out of the synagogue. Now, it's a very Jewish notion that the sins of the parents are visited upon the children. So, because this man was blind, they immediately think, you know, that within his family history there have been some awful sins. And so they, in their pure keeping of the law, are not about to listen to a sinner. Now, this can all start sounding quite anti-Semitic. Again, I want you to recall that the Johannes themselves were Jews. So it's an in-family fight that is being reflected here. It is their Jewish brothers and sisters who refuse to see, who are the Pharisees personified, who refuse to believe the signs and act and live out a faith in Jesus as Lord, which the blind man confesses. Okay, then we have the fourth interview. And instead of someone grilling him with hard questions, Jesus seeks him out this time because he has heard that he's been excommunicated. Again, the blind man probably was not actually excommunicated in reality, but this is perhaps a symbolic way of saying that to these persecuted, harassed people who have been pushed out of their Jewish family, it is to these people that the living Christ comes. Jesus heard they'd thrown him out, and when he found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" That divine title again. "Who is he, sir?" the man asked. "Tell me so that I may believe in him." Within the Jewish understanding of belief, belief is never separated from action. You don't just believe something intellectually. If you believe something, it is part of your entire being, and it's going to influence and shape all that you are and all that you do. So to say that I may believe in him is not just an easy verbal profession of Jesus as Lord, but it means, belief actually means commitment to a person or an idea. And that connotates a risky willingness to act upon that, what you believe to be true. Jesus said, "You have now seen him. In fact, he's the one speaking to you." Then the man said, "Lord, I believe." And he does that radical thing. He worships him. Jesus said, "For judgment I have come into this world, so that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind." We've witnessed that in the very story itself. Those who have sight are the ones who don't see the significance of the sign. The one who is blind is the one who gains physical and total sight. I don't like to say spiritual sight because I think Jesus was a lot more gutsy than just someone who walked around doling out spiritual truths. He was advocating changes in people's lives that led to their being persecuted, excommunicated, and those aren't just spiritual soul truths. Some Pharisees who were with him heard him say this and asked, "What? Are we blind too?" Jesus said, "If you were blind, you would not be guilty of sin. If you didn't see, what you'd be held. But now that you claim you can see, your guilt remains." Any reaction?
I think you're part one in terms of the neighbors complaining. A few years ago we were in Jerusalem. You get an insight into that particular thing. There are an awful lot of beggars sitting around on the street in the old city of Jerusalem, and you're encouraged not to give anything, to contribute to anything, because that only encourages them. The Bedouins go to the extreme of breaking their children's legs so that they'll be cripples and will be able to beg. And so I can understand why the neighbors would be upset. Here was this guy begging all along, and all of a sudden he can see, you know, and they don't want the scam to continue. And I can understand why they would report it.
Yeah, good point. Maybe someone knows. It seems to me that it was part of the Jewish faith that when someone was healed, a leper was cleansed, or some such thing, that you went in and you told the rabbi or the leaders of the synagogue. I know that was true of lepers, so that you could be declared clean and come back into the community. Now, this just occurred to me, and perhaps there was also some such positive aspect to their wanting him to go to the Pharisees. That, you know, hey, God has done something here. Let's get it acknowledged in the community of faith. I'm not sure. That would make it a little less anti-Semitic, too, which, since we've tended to be so anti-Semitic, I think it's important to try and ferret out where that really comes from. Any other reaction? Moving towards what I said we tried to do yesterday, today, that is, look at this story and understand it as to what it meant to the community of faith who first heard it, and the people who recorded it in writing. Understand what it meant to them, then the tough part is to say, okay, this is what this knowledge of Jesus meant in their lives. Now, oftentimes it's easy to leave a Bible study and just go that far, just make it a hermeneutically sound Bible study, where you try and discover what the story meant in the original context and to the original people to whom it was preached. I think what we thought of happened to the blind man happens to people now. Also, what happens to the Pharisees, and the words of the Pharisees here, which are hard words, also happen now. There are a couple alternatives in terms of a reaction to the sign. When Thomas, in the end of the gospel, confesses Jesus as Lord and God, Jesus says, "Blessed are those who believe but who have not seen." So we didn't actually see, any of us, the sign of the healing of the blind man. But that doesn't mean that we don't somehow respond to that act of grace, which the carpenter performed while he was still walking around on 2 feet. The Pharisees reacted in one way, the blind man reacted in one way, the parents in another way. And in a lot of respects, the story of the blind man is a portrait or a description of a faithful disciple. It's the role model held up to the Johannine community, saying, now this is what it means to be faithful. This isn't just what happened to the blind man. It's happening to everyone who's baptized and comes into the family of discipleship. And so there are other options to choose than the response of the blind man. But what the blind man does is he knows Jesus through his experience. We can know Jesus through the sign too. It doesn't have to happen to us in order to smack us, to change our life, to disrupt things, to get people upset, questioning, persecuting, harassing. The sign, the gut knowledge, head knowledge too, he knew for a fact that Jesus had healed his eyes, but he also knew in his total being that Jesus was Lord. And because he realized that this Jesus is not just a carpenter from the northern part of Galilee, but he is the Lord God himself, that he worships him. And he is willing to stand on his feet, answer questions, and take a lot of persecution and hostility from both, and even desertion at times, from his family, the parents, kind of, we don't want to get involved in this. We're afraid of the consequences. He wasn't afraid of the consequences. He dared to risk his understanding of where he could worship, and his understanding of faith was all put on the line in excommunication. I mean, that's entering no man's land. You're getting into a whole new thing. From there, it was a struggle to find out how he could live faithfully. I think a lot of these things can be parallels. And there are personal applications, I think, for us now to the blind man. We're all blind in a lot of ways. I think there are corporate or group consequences, ramifications, applications to the story. Perhaps the blindness of sometimes what sounds like mainstream Christian blindness in the United States. I know, does anybody have some reactions to the application of this story for us now? I have some personal ones, but I'd rather hear yours. Yes?
I was just thinking it's really easier to be blind. It would have been easier for the blind man to stay blind in some ways. And sometimes it's easier for us because we at least know where we stand. And it's pretty risky to see because you don't know what that means for the future. I mean, he at least knew where he was and what he would do with his life. You know, he didn't know what it meant for him afterwards. But that just kind of hit me when you were talking about that corporations, you know, and churches and things like that, you know where you are. But to change is really risky.
Marilyn, would you go into a little bit more how Brown might develop this? This was not an actual account of Jesus?
I think Brown would say it probably was an historical event. It actually occurred, this healing. But it was adapted, or if it wasn't adapted, the parallels to the experience of the community were so close that they began to tell this story at baptism and to use it as a teaching story in terms of what it meant to be a disciple. I don't think Brown, there's no evidence that it did not actually happen. But that's the old story in terms of what these Bible studies are about, the new story within the old story. The old story is the healing of a blind man. That actually occurred, and Jesus healed the sight of a blind man, and we've all heard this story a lot of times. The new story is that Brown is saying, early Christians understood this perhaps as a personification of their own experience. So that's just another layer of meaning. It doesn't obliterate the reality of Jesus actually restoring sight or giving sight to someone who's never seen in their life. Larry?
I was struck by verse 39 where Jesus said, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may become blind." I don't know if you want to say anything more about that identification of Christ or of Jesus with judgment. I'm struck increasingly, in, not just in the Gospel of John, but elsewhere both in the Synoptics and also in Paul, where you have a kind of clash of ages. And Jesus comes, and part of judgment is that the way in which we've been accustomed to things represents the old age. And that is being judged, and it's a complete turnaround to see things differently. It is a new age. And almost all associations of that old age, new age, involve a different way of seeing. What has changed is one's basic perception of things. And then you judge things differently than you judged them before. What was comfortable before becomes uncomfortable. What was satisfying before becomes unsatisfactory. Some things that you never associated with joy. Jesus says, my cross is light. And so on. Now becomes, it's just very different. You get exactly the same thing in the Paul's letter to the Romans. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. That means a different way of seeing things. But it always entails the sharp judgment, the light-darkness motif in John.
Christopher Stendhal says in his book, Paul Among Jew and Gentiles, that we've typically divided judgment and mercy. We think that when God judges, that's one thing. When he's merciful, it's a whole other thing. But Stendhal says that's not Hebrew. Just like to say law and gospel are different things, is not Hebrew. It wasn't the early Christian understanding. It's that it's It's the position from which you see things that changes. Yeah. It's the same action. For some, it will be judgment. For some, it's mercy. It depends on where you stand in relationship to the reality of Jesus as Lord. So what is a judgment of the Pharisees? What is a sign that points and gives sight to the blind man is a judgment of the Pharisees' blindness to a living faith in Yahweh. And so also it's very radical that Jesus would claim that he can judge. To the Jews, that is something for Yahweh alone to do. So it's another instance in which Jesus is expressing his unity with God. But yeah, that good news is bad news is good news is the title of a book in the bookstore. And that's what it's all about, the gospel, you know, that paradox. It sounds great if you're sitting on one side of the fence, and it's going to sound like doomsday if you're on the other. So you have to jump to one side. Well, thank you very much.